Mike. Thank you, bro. Hello, everyone. Welcome. You've joined the BibleBase.com in combination with newliferadio.co.uk with Mike Coles, and excited to bring you another exciting episode of Broken Bread. This is number 15. Mike and I have a little to and fro trying to work out what number this is each time we've done this, but I think we're definitely study number 15 tonight. And the title then is, Why Then the Law? That sounds a bit abrupt, but it comes a bit abrupt. It comes from Galatians chapter 3 and verse 19. If you've got your Bible, and you do really do need to have an open Bible for these little Bible chats and one-sided discussions or conversations that we're having together. And in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 19, we were looking last time at this phrase from verse 14, where Paul speaks about receiving the promise of the Spirit through faith. And then he's making this point that Abraham was outside, in a sense, the old covenant when he believed God. He wasn't joined in a personal covenant in this same way. But God spoke to him. He believed what God had to say to him. And the consequence was that God reckoned Abraham's faith to his account as righteousness. And he's going on with that particular theme. And one of the things he's got to say here now is that if that's the case, and that Abraham was not keeping the law in that sense, if Abraham wasn't undertaking to take upon him the yoke of the law because it wasn't given for another 500 years or more, or 430 years to be precise, that's very precise, isn't it? But you'll see where we get that from in a minute. And then in chapter 3 of Galatians and verse 17, he says this, And this I say, the law, which was 430 years later, that's why I said we could be precise, cannot annul the covenant that was confirmed before by God in Christ, that it should make the promise of none effect. So there's a gap between Abraham being justified by faith and actually entering into a covenant with God, which was sealed with the sign of circumcision. From this point to that point is 430 years. And then he goes on to say, For if the inheritance is of the law, in other words, if you earn this promise of the Spirit, if it's your effort that produces this, you keeping the law, this is a very logical question if you think about it. If the inheritance is of the law, it's no longer a promise. But God gave it to Abraham by promise. And then he asks this typically Pauline logical question. What purpose then does the law serve? Or, as the Greek actually has it, much more short and to the point, why then the law? In other words, if this is true, that Abraham was justified by faith before the law was even in force, what's the point of the law? What's the point of God entering into this special covenant with the people of Israel? What's the point of all those commandments and rules and regulations? What's the point of the temple and the priesthood? What's the point of all that? If it is true that the promise of the Spirit is by faith, and because God has justified us, reckoned us to be right with him on account of faith, and of course our faith based on Christ and his work on the cross, then if that's the case, what's the point of the law? What's the point of it? Well, what is the law? Well, the law was a non-detachable element of the Sinai covenant. It was part of, I don't mean this in any way to be disparaging, but it was part of the Sinai covenant package deal. You know, when God enters into a covenant with you, you can't pick and choose. This isn't a, what we call over here in the UK, this isn't a kind of a mix and pinch buy thing. This is take it or leave it. This is all or nothing. And they entered into this covenant with God, and it says in Exodus chapter 24, I've got my reference here, Moses came and told the people all the words of Jehovah. That's effectively what we call the Ten Commandments, the Jewish call the Ten Words, or the Decalogue, those ten main commandments, although if you think about them, they're actually nine prohibitions rather than commandments. They're a whole list of things that you must not do. I'll leave you to find out the one which is the actual positive commandment. All the words of Jehovah, that's the ten words, and all the ordinances. In chapter 20 of Exodus, God declares these ten words, the basic pattern of life for the people who are entering into covenant with him. And then he adds to that two, three chapters of rules and regulations dealing with all kinds of tiny little details of life. But it says here, all the words of Jehovah, that's the ten words, and all the ordinances, the AV I think says judgments, that's all these others. When Moses had told the people this, when he'd repeated God's terms to the people, it says, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which Jehovah has spoken, we will do. In fact, in the course of entering into this covenant with God, the people of Israel said that three times. First time of asking, second time of asking, third time of asking, all the words which Jehovah has spoken, we will do. So they embraced this covenant in its entirety. You can't pick and mix with this one. You can't leave bits out that don't quite suit you. If you break one part of it, the whole covenant is in jeopardy. And part of this covenant was the priesthood. When you get on to chapter 25 of the book of Exodus, God begins to speak to the people that they are to gather together all kinds of materials, precious stones and jewels and cloths and all kinds of things, and that they are to build for God what he calls a sanctuary. That's a holy place, a place set apart for him. This would be not a church, not something that you have pews and where you go to sing hymns. This would be a mobile palace. This is where God would dwell in the midst of his people, like a nomad in his chieftain in his tent. At the center of his people, God would come and dwell with them. And because this was a holy place where God was going to live, God provided for them a priesthood. You see, under the first part of the covenant, if the covenant dealings had ended with chapter 23, one single infringement of the law, one single breaking of the law, would have brought the whole covenant into jeopardy. In fact, technically, it would have annulled the covenant. It would now be broken, no longer operative, null and void, because someone had broken the terms of the covenant. That's what would have happened. But God provided for them the priesthood. And through these ceremonies, which are highly symbolic and typify aspects of all kinds of areas of the Christian life, through those things, God made a provision for the people so that sins could be forgiven, so that they would have a way of approach toward God, although they were never able to enter into the most holy place, not even the priests, other than the high priest, just on a very special occasion, once a year. So for every high priest, they had special responsibilities, and the book of Hebrews, the letter to the Hebrews, actually takes up the picture of the high priest and applies it to Christ. In fact, it says that Jesus is the reality, and the high priest is actually the shadow cast backwards in time. For every high priest, this is Hebrews chapter 5, for every high priest taken from among men, that's why Jesus had to become one of us, that's why the incarnation was absolutely necessary, not an optional extra, but the whole scheme falls to pieces if he did not become one of us. For every high priest taken from among men is appointed for men, so his representative, in things pertaining to God, that he may offer, and then he says this, that he may offer both. So you're expecting now, aren't you, two things. That he may offer both. Here are the two things. I'll read the whole verse. For every high priest taken from among men is appointed for men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. Do you see that division there? Gifts. These were burnt offerings. These were free will gifts. These were expressions of the people's givenness to God and their thankfulness. But also, in the main, three special offerings, which were sin offerings, which came into being here in Exodus. Actually, there were two other offerings either side of them. One was the burnt offering, and the other was the peace offering. But these were older than Sinai. These had been offered before, but Sinai added these three sin offerings in the middle. And it was because God had provided the priesthood that it effectively gave a kind of a maintenance element to the covenant, so that the covenant didn't break down. There was repair built into it, and the repair was through the priesthood. The Aaronic priesthood, springing from Aaron, was integral to the old Sinai first covenant. That old covenant cannot work if either the law or the priesthood is missing. These two elements of that Mosaic covenant are not detachable. I'm going to say once more, the covenant mediated by Moses is non-functional if the temple and or the priesthood is missing. That's why the new covenant, the old covenant, cannot operate partly in the present day. There is no temple, there are no sacrifices, there are no priests. So the old covenant is no longer functional. It cannot operate. Part of its essential maintenance element have gone. Now, the Sinai covenant, particularly in those Ten Commandments, as we call them, was a unique version, a unique local version, particular version, of what you might call a universal moral law. There's a wonderful time when Jesus was questioned when he was in his earthly ministry, and he asked the question, or they asked him the question, and they said, what is the greatest commandment? And he said, the greatest commandment is this, that you love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. And I guess they were nodding their head. And he said, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And then he said an astonishing thing. He says, on these two commandments, that you must love God with everything you've got, and you must love your neighbor as yourself, on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Everything that was done and said during that 1500 years from Moses right through to the coming of Christ, all the laws, all the way that God led them, all the prophetic words, all of it hangs on two hooks. You can imagine two hooks behind a door, and lots of things being hung on these two hooks. That's the picture. All the commandments hang, and what the prophets have to say, hang on two hooks. And the two hooks are, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, thy soul, thy mind, and thy strength. And the second hook is, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. In fact, in Galatians, Paul goes on to say that all the law is fulfilled in one word. Really? You say? Yes, that's what he says. All the law is fulfilled in one word. Even in this is Galatians chapter 5 and verse 14. You shall love your neighbour as yourself. And you say, well, that isn't one word. No, but you shall love, in the Greek, is one word. All the law is fulfilled in one word. Thou shalt love. You can put it on two separate hooks. The Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength. And on the other hook your neighbour as yourself. But ultimately, it's all one word, thou shalt love. This is the moral law. Now, what God did with the commandments at the time of the Exodus and the time of the Sinai Covenant was that he gave a special focus to these laws for a particular reason, and we'll see what that is in a minute. Let's read this bit here just so that we've got it all before us. This is Galatians chapter 3, and I'm going to read this time from verse 15. Brethren, I speak in the manner of men. Though it's only a man's covenant, yet if it's confirmed, no one annuls it or adds to it. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He does not say, and to seeds, as of many, but as of one, and to your seed, who is Christ. We'll see the relevance of that later. And this I say, listen carefully now, please. The law, which was 430 years later, cannot annul the covenant that was confirmed before by God in Christ, that it should make the promise of no effect. For if the inheritance is of the law, it's no longer a promise. But God gave it by promise. So Paul says, you can't add something to this covenant that God made with Abraham when Abraham believed God and entered into that relationship. You can't then add things to that. It would be like God having to say to Abraham, well, you got to keep, I've given you this, but you've got to keep all these laws as well. This is in the small print at the bottom of the contract. There's no small print at the bottom of the contract. Abraham believed Jehovah, and the Lord counted it to him for righteousness. No small print. So, and you can't annul it, not without the consent of both parties. I suppose you could break it, and then it becomes non-existing. So the promise, let me put it like this, the promise can stand on its own feet. The law can't. The law, you see, was added to the promise for a specific purpose, we shall see in a moment. But the promise is added to nothing. The promise is a standalone promise. It's by grace through faith. Absolutely, that's it. That is the ground of a man being right with God and declared right with God. Abraham received circumcision as a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while he was still uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all those who believe, though they are uncircumcised, that righteousness might be imputed to them also, and the father of circumcision to those who not only are of the circumcision, but who also walk in the steps of the faith which our father Abraham had while still uncircumcised. That's Romans chapter 4. So, did the law fail? Well, in its purpose. Well, it failed in the way that a spanner, or you, as you Americans call them, a wrench, fails as a tool for slicing bread. That a spanner, a wrench, is an utter failure as a tool for slicing bread. But then it was never designed as a method for slicing bread. And the law was never designed as a method for acquiring righteousness which would gain access to God. So that wasn't the purpose. So if that's what you thought the purpose was, it was an absolute abject failure. But then that wasn't in the plan. That wasn't the purpose of the law. So what is the purpose of the law? We're back to our question. Verse 19. What purpose then does the law serve? Or, as we said, it says, what then? The law. What's the purpose of it? So there's your question. Let's trace the history of it. We mentioned that it came into force 430 years after Abraham was justified by faith. So consequently, it can't annul, it can't cancel, it can't undo that basic commandment. It can't, you can't add conditions afterwards to it. Then it says in here in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 19, what was its purpose? It was added. Now, if you're observant, you may have noticed that in verse 15, Paul writes, brethren, I speak in the manner of men, though it's only a man's covenant, yet if it is confirmed, no one annuls or adds to it. So you can't add to it. But here in verse 19, he says, what purpose then does the law serve? It was added. So is he contradicting himself? No. They're quite different words. They're translated both by the English word added, but really we ought to have found a better word. This one means to put something by the side of. This law was not integrated into the promise. It's not integral to the promise. These are two quite separate things. They're side by side. They have a relationship for the people of Israel. They have to obey the injunctions that God had given to them. It's different for the Gentile. We'll see that in a minute or two. So it was added. It was put by the side of it. I'm still in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 19. It's wonderful, this verse. It's wonderful how wonderfully it answers Paul's own question. He says, well, what's the purpose of it then? And here's his answer. Listen to his answer. It was added because of transgressions. Okay, so that's why it was added. It was added because of transgressions. It was added to give a focus to transgressions. A transgression is a crossing over of a known line. Where there is no law, Paul wrote to the Romans, there is no transgression. If there's no law, you can't break it. If you don't break the law, there's no transgression. I remember I've got a son who's a senior officer in the armed forces, and he wanted to give some kind of leniency to his men, and we were talking about it, and I said, don't give them an order. I said, because when there's no law, there's no transgression. They can't transgress the law if you haven't given them a law. And he took it up. I'm not quite sure how the British Army functions, but that is part of it. Maybe not at all. Anyway, how long did this law last? How long was it intended to last? Well, in human terms, in years, it lasted for about 1,500 years. This is just a rule of thumb. But if we say that Moses received the law about 1,500 BC, then add 30 years to that, when Christ died on the cross and brought that covenant to an end, and you've got about 1,530 years, approximately. But Paul doesn't give it that kind of time. He doesn't measure it in times. He says this. It was added, but we know when it was added. It was added at Sinai. That's when it was added. How long was it going to last? Until the seed should come. So, its active duration was to be from the time that Moses received that covenant and acted as the mediator bringing Israel into that unique relationship with God that made them his people, and the time when the seed came. That's why I said approximately 1,500 years or something like that. In other words, until Christ. That law, that covenant, with all its splendor, all its magnificent symbolism, all its beauty, its gold, its silver, all its powerful expressions of God's presence, all that was intended to last only until Christ came. Only until Christ came. Until the seed should come to whom the promise was made. And we're going to have to look at this the next time we're together. That promise was made to Abraham and his seed. Jesus becomes the carrier of the promise as the seed is the carrier of life. We'll see how that works out. To whom the promise was made, and it was appointed through angels by the hand of a mediator. There you are, Moses was the mediator of the first one. Now, a mediator does not mediate for one only, but God is one. Is the law then against the promises of God? Certainly not. Well, okay, we've said that it's added because of transgression. It's added so that sin can be quantified. You see, if I say to myself, oh, I'm fit. Yes, I'm really fit. How are you going to challenge that question? But if you give me a list and you say, well, if you're fit, you'll be able to run up and down these stairs three times without your heart rate going above this, and it'll recover in this amount of time. If you're fit, you'll be able to run 100 yards in so many seconds. If you're fit, you'll be able to jog for a couple of miles if you're fit, and so on and so on. Now, when I say, no, well, I'm not fit in that case. In other words, it enables me to quantify my unfitness. Now, sin became exceeding sinful. It became absolutely crystal clear because these laws sensitized the people of Israel to sin. I was talking to some Finnish sisters at one time, and we were talking about, I'm interested in language, although I'm no linguist, and we were talking about snow, because I had a theory and I wanted to test it, and I said, how many different words do you have for snow in Finland? And they went away, and a couple of weeks, I think it was later, they came back with two pages. There were dozens and dozens of them. There was snow, and then there was driving snow, and then there was melting snow, and then there was snow that you could skate on, or snow that you could ski on, or snow that fell on top of other snow, and it just went on and on and on and on. You see, living as they do, where they do, the Finns are highly snow-sensitized. For us here, well, snow's snow, isn't it? It's snow. That's it. It's just snow. But for these people, snow is not just snow. It's all different kinds of snow. Sin, well, that's just a big kind of all-inclusive word. But once you begin to break it down, once you begin to give different words for it, and I've forgotten the exact number, but I did count them once, I think the Hebrew language has 15 different words for sin. You see, as the result of this law, the people of Israel became highly sin-sensitized. That was the purpose of it. The purpose was to make sin exceeding sinful so that they would see. Okay, so that's one of the things it did. It came so that sins could be quantified or counted. Then Paul says this, Galatians chapter 3, verse 23. He says, before faith came, we were kept in ward under the law, shut up until the faith which should afterwards be revealed. Or as another version says, now before faith came, we were held in custody under the law, being kept as prisoners until the coming faith should be revealed. You say, well, this is kind of strong stuff. Well, this is one of the things that the law did. As well as sensitizing people to their failure to keep it, it actually acted as a kind of restraining. It provided barriers and limitations so that they knew where they stood concerning certain things. And they were, it was like a prison. It depends which side the fence you are, know what a prisoner is. In the book of Job, both Job and Satan complain that God has put a hedge around Job. Satan complains because he can't get in. Job complains because he can't get out. It just depends which side the fence you're in. And the law was like that. The law held them in covenant, in custody, under the law. Maybe they were in protective custody to a certain degree, but that's where they were. Until, here's that word again, until. You see, the law was only ever intended to be temporary. So they were held in custody until the faith should be revealed. We'll come back to that in a minute. And then there's another one here. Paul goes on to say, therefore, the law was... Now, this is the New King James Version. The law was our tutor to bring us to Christ. Let's just stop with that bit for a minute. Our tutor. That really is a very inadequate translation. You see, this word tutor is not an educator of any kind. It's a Greek word, paedagogos, and the paedagogos was usually a slave, and he had a special task. And I sometimes say that he was a little boy's worst nightmare, because he was the little boy's personal policeman. It was the job of the paedagogos, a child conductor, to ensure that the little boy didn't get into trouble, to make sure that he went where he was supposed to be going. The paedagogos wasn't allowed to instruct or teach. His job was to make sure the little boy got to the instructor, to the teacher. So that's the picture here. There are pictures, other pictures, old ancient Greek pictures of paedagogos, and you have the paedagogos and he has the little boy by the ear. Or some of the paedagogos actually have a little whip in there encouraging their charges to get along to their lessons. Therefore, the law was our child conductor to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. You see, the law had, it hedged us in, it closed us in, and then it hustled us along the way. I don't know if you've ever seen them kind of herding cattle into trucks for transport and that, and they have these kind of movable fences, and they slowly move them into a funnel so that the cattle or the sheep slowly come into that, and then they have nowhere else to go except into the back of the truck. That's it. And if they're not moving quickly enough, they'll get a dog at the rear, nipping at their heels and just kind of urging them on so that they've got nowhere else to go and they're going to get there quickly. Well, these are two amazing pictures here. They're hedged in, held in custody, so there's nowhere else they can go. And the law's behind them as their tutor, hurrying them along the way to get them to Christ. So what's the purpose of the law? Yes, it was to make them sin conscious, to make them aware of their need, and to add urgency to their coming to their Saviour. That's what it is. We'd better stop there. That's the purpose of the law. There's Paul's question, and there's his answer. So what use does it have for us now? We'll leave that, maybe attach it onto the front of next session. Paul wrote to Timothy, here's your clue. And he says, there are some who misuse the law. But the law, he says, is good if someone uses it lawfully. Rules and regulations can have a purpose in our lives, but we need to understand and have it crystal clear that they never enable us to acquire merit. They never enable us to acquire righteousness, our own righteousness that we can stand in and so insist upon access to God. That always and only has to be by grace, through faith. Good night. The Lord bless you, God willing. I look forward to seeing you same time, same place, next week.